Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moscowane has the day off today. The midterm elections are less than 3 months away, and as summer winds down, political campaigns will be once again revving up. So this hour, we bring you up to speed on what's been happening across the tri-state area thus far. We'll get to some big races in New Jersey and Pennsylvania in just a moment, but we begin this hour with the first state. Incumbent Democratic Senator Tom Carper is being challenged by a political newcomer by the name of Carrie Evelyn Harris in Delaware's primary election. That's in just a couple of weeks. Joining us with an in-depth look at this story and more is Mark Eichmann, Deputy Managing Editor of WHYY's Delaware Desk. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Mary. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So Delaware is one of the last states to hold a primary election. Primary day is coming up fast, September 6th. Tom Carper has served in some form of public office for decades. He's been governor, he's been congressman, as well as senator. But Mark, this time around, and perhaps for the first time in memory, he is being challenged in a primary election. Tell us about Carrie Evelyn Harris. Who is she?
Well, she's a community organizer. She served in the Air Force right after 9/11 as a loadmaster on the giant cargo planes that fly in and out of Dover Air Force Base. After leaving the military about a decade ago, she started working a number of odd jobs to keep herself together. And since then, she's worked as a auto body mechanic. She's mowed lawns and has a lot of experience in struggling to make it, like a lot of people do these days. And she uses that as her pitch as she's challenging Tom Carper, that she's connected to the community. She's connected to the struggles of people who struggle to make it to week to week and paycheck to paycheck. And she looks at Senator Carper as a career politician, which he certainly is, first being elected as Delaware State Treasurer in 1976 and never losing an election since then. He's certainly been very successful. But she kind of points to that success as putting him out of touch, that he isn't really connected to the needs or the struggles of the community as maybe he once was, now being a senator for three terms, hoping to become a fourth-term senator. She's definitely coming at him from the left. She's, would consider herself more progressive than Tom Carper, who is a moderate Democrat and kind of prides himself on being able to reach across the aisle and work with Republicans in a bipartisan way. He says that's really the only way you can get things done with the Senate as tight as it is between Republicans and Democrats. So she's coming at him from the left, and she's certainly not anywhere near the fundraiser that Senator Carper is. It's sort of a landslide in the fundraising department. He has several $1 million in the bank in donations over the past year and a half. She has less than $60,000 in her bank. So it really is kind of a David versus Goliath story.
I was just thinking that. Yeah.
But she kind of embraces that she's. I talked to her last week about facing the giant that is Senator Carper, and as successful as he's been, and she says she's not necessarily the David, it's the people who are the David, and that they need a voice in Washington, and that she would be that voice.
She is also, she's biracial, and she is openly gay. If she were to win election to office, would she be the first openly gay person to do so in Delaware?
Yes. For federal office, for sure. Mm-hmm. And I asked her about that as well, because it's not really something that's been she's not touting that as a reason to vote for her, for sure. And, she said the history of it didn't really strike her until she was asked about it when she decided to run. And she doesn't look at herself necessarily as a history maker. She's hoping that were she to be elected, she would sort of open the door that everybody would be represented in Washington, that it wouldn't be, she was looking forward to the day where it wouldn't be a historical moment for someone like her to be elected, that it would be commonplace, is how she kind of looks at it. She served in the Air Force, as I mentioned, and when she served, she was serving under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And she told me that Once she left the military, she decided she would never live her life that way again. She would be who she was no matter what, and that's how she carries herself.
So it's been a while since Tom Carper has had to debate somebody in a primary. There was a debate held last night. Harris had challenged him to a debate. Now, Tom Carper was not there. What's the story behind that, Mark?
He was in Washington, apparently taking care of some Senate business, and so Harris debated one of the Republicans also running. There's a primary on the Republican side too. Only one of those candidates showed up as well, so it was one Democrat versus one Republican when there's four people total in the race. There is another debate scheduled for next Monday night that's hosted by the News Journal, which is Delaware's major newspaper. And Carper is expected to be at that debate, as he was expected to be at last night's debate, so we'll wait and see what happens there next week.
Let's talk about some of the issues. Health care, Tom Carper, and Carrie Evelyn Harris.
Harris is supporting a Medicare for All program. Again, it goes back to her sort of being of the people and struggling week to week. And she says even those people who do have access to health care insurance sometimes aren't even able to use it because of financial reasons and are throwing money away. Carper, a supporter of the Affordable Care Act, as is Harris, who went to Washington and sort of part of a grassroots effort to support the Obamacare and prevent its repeal and replacement, which was successful even in a Republican Congress.
So Carper opposes Medicare for All? Am I understanding that correctly?
I'm not 100% sure on Carper's position on Medicare for All. I know he was a supporter of the Affordable Care Act for sure.
Okay. You know, back to Carrie Evelyn Harris, we were talking about the David and Goliath analogy. You know, some are pointing to 28-year-old Democratic Socialist Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, you know, of course, flabbergasted a lot of people by unseating a 10-term New York Democrat in a primary in June. You know, again, Harris has not raised nearly the amount that Carper has. But some are saying, why not Evelyn Harris?
Yeah, and Harris is definitely saying that as well. She was very much a supporter of Ocasio-Cortez in New York and even took some of her campaign staff from Delaware to New York in the final days of that primary in June to help Cortez get the vote out and was a big supporter of her. They have a lot in common belief-wise and platform-wise. And so when Ocasio-Cortez won, that was a big boost for the Harris campaign. And, you know, they thought the same thing. Why not us? Why can't we do the same thing here in Delaware? While Ocasio-Cortez considers herself maybe a Democratic Socialist, Carrie Evelyn Harris sort of distances herself from that label. She said that she is a Democrat, and she said if you have a dispute in the family, as some of the Democratic Socialists might have with some of the Democratic Party stands, Harris said you don't leave your family name. You work within your family to fix problems you might have with that family, as she might see problems within the Democratic Party. So she doesn't consider herself a Democratic Socialist, but a Democrat who sees things within the party that need to be fixed, and maybe more of a focus on the needs of community and individuals rather than the needs of corporations, which she points to Senator Carper and his war chest and his donations from corporate political action committees as being, if not servant to those corporate interests, there's a perception that he is a servant to those interests, according to Harris.
Mark, is Delaware a reliably blue state? What's your take? I mean, do either of the Republicans in this race have a chance?
If you look at the voting voter rolls and the number of Democrats versus the number of Republicans, the answer would be no. Democrats outnumber Republicans here 2-1. And while Republicans are gaining numbers in southern Delaware, where there's a lot of folks moving in and retiring to Delaware, the Democrats still have a big hold on numbers as far as voters go. That's why it usually ends up being that the Democratic primary in Delaware, we saw this 2 years ago in the city of Wilmington, the Democratic primary for mayor was de facto the election. Yeah. And it's usually that's the case here. And I think it would be a very long shot for either the Republicans to win in the general election. But I guess that's why we have elections, and it will be a long shot, but you never know.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, that's for sure. Okay, well, let's before we let you go, let's take a look at Delaware State Attorney General's race. As of Monday, we have a new addition and a new Republican, Bernard Pepakai.
Yeah, he announced over the weekend at his church that he was jumping into the race. He's someone who has been a longtime Democrat and switched parties to be the Republican nominee. They've had some difficulty in getting a candidate for that race. The Delaware's Attorney General, currently Matt Dehn, is stepping down and will not run again. And so this field is kind of wide open, but again, on the more so on the Democratic side, where there's four candidates running. And for the new Republican candidate to get into the race, really this late in the game, is probably, it's sort of just so the Republicans can have a name on the ballot, but I don't expect him to mount much of a challenge to whoever the winner of the Democratic primary will be.
And he says this is not about political opportunism, switching parties at the last minute to get in.
I guess that's the position you take when you switch parties to run when the Republicans couldn't come up with a candidate, and that's the way you have to spin it.
All right, Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester, a Democrat, became the first woman and first African American to win Delaware's only House seat 2 years ago. Any significant challenge to her?
No, not at all.
All right, that was great. All right, well, and so, what sort of turnout, Mark, do you think is expected at the polls September 6th? What is the Carper race, the Carper-Harris race, going to generate enough interest to get people out there just a couple months before the general election?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I think it's something that I think Senator Coons, who's Delaware's other senator, kind of trying to stoke the Democratic faithful and the party faithful to get out and not take it for granted that Carper will win. And I think that's the shot that Harris has, that she's able to use her grassroots experience to get more of her people to the polls on. And it's a weird primary in Delaware. Usually the primaries are on Tuesdays. This is on September 6th because of some scheduling.
It's a Thursday, isn't it?
Right. The way the calendar fell, it's not only just a Thursday, it's also opening night for the Eagles in their Super Bowl defense. So there's a lot going on that day. So it will be interesting to see whether or not Harris can get her numbers out and pull off what would be a epic upset.
Okay, stay tuned. Mark Eichmann, Deputy Managing Editor of WHYY's Delaware Desk. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
All right, up next on Radio Times, we take a look at what's happening in New Jersey. Stay with us. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's off today. Democrats are hoping a blue wave swamps New Jersey in November, and there's indication that at the very least, the state's purple areas could take on a bluer tinge. Joining us now with a look at some important congressional races and the battle facing Democratic U.S. Senator Bob Menendez is Nick Corasiniti. He covers New Jersey for the New York Times. Hello, Nick.
Hi, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Doing well, thanks.
So let's take a look at the Senate race first. It has not been an easy couple of years for Democratic incumbent Robert Menendez. A quick refresher for us, Nick. Last fall, he was on trial. He faced corruption charges, I should say. A mistrial was declared, but this has been following him through 2018.
Yeah, it was a real whiplash beginning of the year for Senator Menendez. You know, he ends his trial in November with a hung jury. So he claims that that's a victory. He proclaims his innocence. He makes that famous quote from the courthouse steps, a very New Jersey political quote that for those who are dancing on his political grave, he knows who they are and he will find them. Hmm. So then in January, the Department of Justice announces that they're going to retry Senator Menendez, which, you know, threatens him running for re-election while having a trial hanging over his head. Then a few weeks later, the judge who presided over the initial case, Judge Walls, throws out a couple key charges, and with that, a couple very key pieces of evidence for the government's case. So then just a few days later, the DOJ says they are now dropping the case, dropping all charges, freeing Senator Menendez to run for re-election with nothing legally hanging over his head.
Yeah, he was sanctioned by the Senate Ethics Committee, though.
Exactly. That's what I was just about to get to. So it was a few weeks later, a bipartisan group of senators. So it wasn't even a Republican-led initiative, but his colleagues like Senator Brian Schatz wrote a letter severely admonishing him for his behavior. And with that, and not to mention a very, very wealthy Republican opponent who has been running a bunch of ads reminding New Jerseyans about his corruption trial and the charges and the admonishment, it's something that Senator Menendez has not exactly been able to escape with just 80 days to go, or 80 or so days to go before November.
Well, we'll talk about his Republican opponent, Bob Hugin, in just a moment. But I'd like to just focus on the May primary for a minute or two here. A political neophyte, you know, Lisa McCormick, who spent apparently just about no money, won the support in the Democratic primary for U.S. Senate of nearly 4 in every 10 Democratic voters in New Jersey. Nick, what happened there?
Some people are saying it's a protest vote, and I certainly think that was a decent part of it. You know, there were a lot of Democrats who were kind of frustrated with the political machine in New Jersey rallying so quickly around Senator Menendez. And, you know, in New Jersey, the machine is so strong with the county endorsements and the county line, which gives you preferential placement on a ballot, that it made it near impossible for a real challenge, or so it seemed, for a real challenge to a primary challenge to come for Senator Menendez. So I think a lot of people who were disgusted with what they found out of the trial, which got, you know, near gavel to gavel coverage by both local and national media, were frustrated at the lack of options. So they walked into a voting booth in June on primary day and voted for a complete unknown. I mean, Lisa McCormick didn't even raise the necessary $5,000 to meet a threshold required to file an FEC report.
Yeah.
So there was certainly a lot of, I think, unrest and anger in the Democratic base that you saw in manifest itself in other upsets around the country, you know, really eager for new blood. At the same time, though, like you said, we'll get back to Bob Hugin. You know, before the primary, Mr. Hugin had been airing negative attack ads almost at a clip of $1 million per week. You know, hammering Senator Menendez for the corruption trial, for things that came out during the trial. So voters were reminded very close to the polls, and that includes Democratic voters, you know, of everything that Senator Menendez went through.
And so that could have helped McCormick, then, you're saying?
Exactly. She had the, while she only raised, you know, some $4,000, she did have some air cover in a sense of a negative ad blitz kind of raining down on Senator Menendez right before the primary began.
So quickly, before we get on to Hugin, who are the Democratic big names, if you will, supporting Menendez in New Jersey? Governor Murphy?
Like a who's who.
Yeah.
Yes, Governor Murphy. Senator Cory Booker is an incredible ally of Senator Menendez. He considers him a mentor. He even, you know, took the political risk of testifying for Senator Menendez at his trial. You know, whenever you go see Senator Booker speak, it can be these kind of soaring orations, and, you know, he'll sometimes go down different paths. But when he starts talking about Senator Menendez, it'll be like a 10-minute aside of just these platitudes. So he's got the two top statewide elected officials in Murphy and Booker supporting him. He also has the support of very key kind of political power brokers in New Jersey. There's George Norcross, who is a very powerful figure in the southern part of the state. There's Joe D in the northern part of the state, and Lou Stellato, who's the Bergen County chair. So it's almost every key Democrat in New Jersey has been vocally supportive of Senator Menendez, and also, you know, offering their turnout operations and fundraising operations to his reelection effort.
It remains to be seen whether this translates into a win in November. So, all right, Nick. Now, so Bob Hugin. Who is he, and is he associated politically with President Trump?
He is trying to say that he isn't. So Hugin is a former pharmaceutical executive. He was he rose at Celgene, which is a pharmaceutical company in New Jersey that makes its main drug is Revlimid, which is for cancer patients. And he was also a very close ally of former Governor Chris Christie. Now, when it comes to President Trump, Mr. Hugin donated about, I think it's $500,000 to his inaugural fund. And he sat on the first meeting that President Trump had with drug companies. He actually sat right next to him. So there's a pretty well-known picture. And we've become more well-known once Senator Menendez and his allies start running negative ads of Hugin sitting right next to Trump and kind of smiling. But since then, and since he's announced, he's tried to kind of brand himself as this new Republican. You know, he is a pro-choice Republican. He has come out for in favor of same-sex marriage. He's criticized the Trump administration's practice of separating families at the border. So he's trying to almost run away from Trump, but he certainly has a little bit of a record before then of being closely aligned to both Trump and someone who's even more unpopular than President Trump in New Jersey, and that's former Governor Chris Christie.
In Hugin's background, his former company Celgene settled a huge lawsuit for, I think it was, what, $280 million, claiming Celgene marketed cancer drugs improperly. Was this on Hugin's watch?
It was. While he was, I believe he was chairman of the board at that time, he might have just recently, it was while he was executive chairman of the company. They had to settle a lawsuit, like you said, for $280 million, where they were charged by in a whistleblower lawsuit with off-market labeling. So their main drug had only been approved for a certain type of treatment by the FDA. I believe it was some kind of brand of leprosy or a strain of leprosy. And they were supposedly, according to the allegations in the lawsuit, calling doctors and saying, you can prescribe this for these types of cancers when it hadn't yet been approved. Now, Celgene claims that they did no wrongdoing. They only settled just to make it go away so they could focus on development of furthering Revlimid and other cancer drugs. So they still claim that despite the settlement, there was no wrongdoing. But yes, it was under Hugin's watch.
So at this point, does this seem to be something that is possibly hurting his chances? Or do you have a sense that the average New Jersey voter or Republican is paying attention to this?
Well, the reason that it hasn't necessarily become central to the race is because Senator Menendez has waited what would traditionally seem like a normal time. You know, not many midterm campaigns really ramp up until around Labor Day. But because Hugin went on the air so early and has been kind of hitting Menendez, everyone's been waiting for a counterpunch. And it wasn't until this morning, actually, that he even went up on TV with his first advertisement.
And what was that like?
It's a little bit of a contrast ad. It's not as negative as you would expect, although it would be, it's never necessarily a good idea for a politician to make their first television ad a pure negative hit. They'll either go for a bio spot or the occasional contrast. So this is more of a contrast. It's, you know, Senator Menendez walking around Union City, where he's from, which is also where, Hugin's from, but saying, you know, I've never forgotten my roots. I fight for healthcare, and, you know, Hugin raised the price of cancer drugs on cancer patients. I've, you know, fought for, the rights of immigrants, and, you know, Hugin sided with Republicans. So it's more of a contrast. It's not as negative as I think we'll start to see once this race gets uglier and uglier. Mm. But I think that's why this, Hugin's record at Celgene hasn't necessarily received the kind of spotlight that you might expect, especially at a time when drug prices and pharmaceutical companies are really, facing the ire of residents in the United States. And it's a real bipartisan anger. You know, President Trump has been tweeting about this. I think he targeted Pfizer specifically, but his FDA commissioner, Gottlieb, has started, quote unquote, naming and shaming any pharmaceutical companies that receive complaints that they're, you know, not making the drug available to generic drug manufacturers, which would therefore lower the prices. Yeah. So it's something that's certainly palpable in terms of its anger and its potency within the electorate. But it just because Menendez hasn't necessarily been on air and a lot of media hasn't necessarily started digging into Hugin still pre-Labor Day, I don't think it's necessarily reached the New Jersey electorate.
But on the flip side, since Hugin's been throwing punches for months, I mean, are some pundits thinking perhaps it would be wise for Menendez to counterpunch a little bit earlier than he has? Or come out swinging, I should say, now as opposed to waiting?
Sure. There was a, I think that maybe political experts are divided because there's still that adage that, you know, no one really pays attention to a midterm race before Labor Day. So you risk just kind of wasting money. But that didn't take into account just how aggressive the Hugin campaign was in, you know, kind of blanketing the airwaves. And they were very smart to focus on the World Cup, which, you know, had immense viewership. They would just run ads in the pre-show and the post game. All kind of hammering Menendez and really getting a captured audience, especially in New Jersey where soccer is so popular.
All right. Go ahead, finish.
When I spoke to a lot of voters when I was doing a story, kind of previewing the race in August, all of them were like, I haven't seen, you know, Menendez. I haven't seen an ad, and all I see are Hugin ads. I haven't seen him necessarily campaign around. So I think there was, if not amongst the punditry class or the quote-unquote chattering class of Washington, some kind of like, desire to see Menendez punch back amongst his supporters, there certainly was.
All right, a couple of comments we've been getting in from Facebook and email. Facebook comment from Aaron about the Senate race. Establishment Democrats thought it was a better idea to run the incumbent instead of running new blood. So here we are. And then also an email from Barbara in Cherry Hill. The elephant in the room, the majority of registered voters in New Jersey are unaffiliated. We need to open the primaries and we will see a real change. So just very quickly, Nick, because I'd like to get on to some congressional races before we wrap up. What do you think of both?
Well, with regards to the first point, I think that's something that we're seeing across the country. There's an extreme kind of desire amongst the Democratic base for new blood and for change. You saw it in the upset of Ocasio-Cortez in New York.
Yeah.
I actually just did a story about a mayor in Lambertville, New Jersey. She was then 27-year-old. She challenged a mayor who was an incumbent for 27 years. So he was elected the year she was born, and she upset him. So I think everywhere we're seeing this desire for change. What happened with the Senate race and with the incumbent is kind of what I was speaking about earlier, that the force of the political machine really rallied around and kind of encompassed Senator Menendez so much so that it was difficult for anyone to really kind of mount a meaningful challenge to him, or so it seemed. Now, when people saw that protest vote, they thought, had someone maybe thrown their hat in the ring and, you know, been willing to put up a fight and go against the machine, maybe they would have won. But I still think you can't underestimate the power of those power brokers in New Jersey. Now, with regards to the open primary, that's another thing that we're hearing kind of around the country, a desire that for many voters who feel boxed out of a certain, you know, they feel almost disenfranchised. And especially in a state like New York or New Jersey, which is still heavily blue, sometimes the primary is really the election. You know, had this maybe not been Senator Menendez with some of his flaws and problems over the past year, it might just be a foregone conclusion that the Democrat would win. We saw that in the governor's race last year with Governor Murphy.
So what are the odds that we're going to see an open primary in New Jersey anytime soon?
It's tough to place odds on it, but I definitely wouldn't, now that we have sports betting in New Jersey.
Don't hold your breath.
I would not be laying any money or mortgages on that. You know, political change comes increasingly slow in this country, and also an open primary threatens the people in power. So rarely do you see people in power, you know, kind of weaken their own stance.
All right. So some congressional races of note, as we've heard, for the most part, the National Democratic Party is really watching New Jersey. We've got a couple of districts in particular in which the long-term Republican incumbents have decided not to run for re-election, the 2nd and the 11th, Frank Lobiondo in the 2nd, Rodney Frelinghuysen in the 11th. In the 2nd, let's take a quick close look. The Republican candidate Seth Grossman lost the endorsement of the National Committee to Elect House Republicans. Some nasty business there. Very quickly, Nick, what was that about? And does his Democratic competitor, State Senator Jeff Van Drew, now, is he a shoo-in?
He's probably as close to a shoo-in as it gets in New Jersey. Seth Grossman, you know, right after he kind of won the primary and the National Republican Party, in an article by Matt Freeman of Politico, kind of said that they were really struggling with recruitment there. And so Seth Grossman wins the primary, and almost immediately after we start to see all of these statements he's made in the past, saying diversity is a cancer, speaking really disparagingly about segregation, about Islam. And it just kind of grew to such a boiling point. And there was so much evidence that, you know, of all these past statements that he had said, that the NRCC pulled their support. Already it was going to be difficult for him to win. The second district was...
Even with a Republican in there for decades?
Yes, because what Representative Lobiondo did was kind of form a very strong coalition of Republicans, rural voters, and labor there. He had always kind of tried to be a champion for labor, who traditionally vote Democratic.
Yeah.
So while there was no real chance at upsetting Representative Lobiondo, as soon as he was gone, Democrats were eager to pick this up.
Okay,
and
so,
they had viewed...
Oh, go ahead. Very quickly.
And they had viewed... State Senator Jeff Van Drew as, you know, kind of he's very moderate. He's got an A rating from the NRA as someone who could really kind of come in and win a district that, you know, had been held by a Republican for two decades.
Nick, we've only got a minute, which is why, and I'm sorry, we're rushing things along, but the 11th and the 3rd. So Democrat Mikey Sherrill, background, which has won the attention and affection of Democratic officials. She's raised a lot more money than her opponent, Republican State Assemblyman Jay Weber. Does it seem as if she might win the day here?
She is, the race, I believe, is rated by the Cook Report as lean Democrat, but it's still very difficult. Rodney Frelinghuysen has been in that seat for years. It's a very traditional Republican area. But what it is kind of a prototypical suburban revolt that we've seen since President Trump was elected. You know, it kind of manifested itself in the Virginia gubernatorial last year. So a lot of traditional Republican suburbs are kind of, especially with like higher educated voting base, especially among women, are kind of revolting against the Republican Party. So Mikey Sherrill is kind of the prime candidate to benefit from that. But it's certainly going to be a very, very tight race.
Okay.
Just given the demographics.
10 seconds. Third district, a Republican incumbent Tom MacArthur, Democrat Andy Kim. Dead heat, according to a Monmouth University poll. What do you think? 10 seconds.
It's going to be a very difficult upset for Andy Kim to pull off, but that poll is as good a news as he's seen since he announced his campaign.
All right, Nick Corasaniti of The New York Times, thank you so much for joining us. Pennsylvania, straight ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WHYY in Philadelphia. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We wrap up our look at local politics now with the state of Pennsylvania. John Misek is editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live. He has also served for many years as a state government reporter for the Morning Call in Allentown. And welcome to Radio Times, John.
Good morning.
So let's get right to the governor's race. Democratic incumbent Tom Wolf is being challenged in the general election by Republican Scott Wagner. And at this point, it would seem as if Wagner has an uphill climb.
That is certainly the case, although if you ask the Wagner people this morning, they will tell you the race is a dead heat. Yesterday, we were treated to a poll drop by a third-party Republican group funded by some wealthy Republican types, showing the race was in the margin of error. The sampling there was top-heavy with conservatives, so that might attribute it to it. But you're right, Mary. Right now, the polling average shows Governor Wolf up by about 16 points on average. She's ahead on fundraising. And it's always tough unseating a incumbent Pennsylvania governor. But on the other hand, Tom Wolf won election in 2014 by unseating an incumbent Republican governor. So it is an interesting time. But right now, it feels like the momentum, at least, is on Governor Wolf's side.
Well, the Wolf-Wagner contest, it's an ugly contest. Each is representing the other as, let's start with education, as the anti-public education candidate. They're calling each other liar. Each has had to walk back remarks, which were then seized upon by their opponents. John, if you would give us a quick synopsis, quick if you can. It's pretty tangled.
So it started almost immediately after the May primary, with the Wolf people drawing first blood, trying to brand Scott Wagner, who like Governor Wolf, by the way, hails from York County, thrusting York County into the statewide political spotlight in a way that it hasn't been for a number of years, as the, quote, worst of Harrisburg. The Wagner team, meanwhile, has tried to punch back, saying that Governor Wolf has been ineffectual as a leader, you're pointing to his failure to sign three consecutive budgets, although I'm not sure how many people lose sleep at night wondering whether the governor has signed a budget into law or not, as long as all the money is there and the numbers add up. And they have since sparred over any number of things, this being the rapid-fire campaign that it is. It seems like issues crop up the same way that dandelions do in the summertime. But you notably did mention that that spat over public education funding. The governor back at the end of July mentioned that he'd prefer implementation of this fair funding formula, which is supposed to change the way that Pennsylvania pays for public schools and levy the playing field. Senator Wagner's people pounced on that immediately, even pointing out that that a immediate implementation of the fair funding formula would cost result in a $1 billion shift, disproportionately impacting poor and rural schools. They were claiming that Governor Wolf was trying to cut $1 billion from public education. The administration had to rapidly double back to clarify its remarks and say, no, we don't support the immediate implementation of the fair funding formula. We realize full well the ramifications of what would happen if that were the case. And they have fought back and forth ever since over that. It's surprising a bit how long that's gone. Particularly given former Senator Wagner's longstanding disdain for public education. He has at some certain points said that public schools have more than enough money, that if 10% of Pennsylvania's teachers were laid off tomorrow, that nobody would know the difference. He has gleefully battled with the Pennsylvania State Education Association, which is the state's largest public teachers union. So to try to see him position himself as the champion of public education has been an interesting thing to watch, to say the least.
Are the unions buying it?
I don't think so. No, they remain squarely in Governor Wolf's camp.
So, John Micek, you point out in a recent article that the perception of a candidate as anti-public schools can cost them the election. And you point back to a Republican, Tom Corbett.
That's exactly right. Insofar as we have a third rail in Pennsylvania politics, public education has always been it. Governor Corbett, who was elected in 2010 and lost to Governor Wolf in 2014, largely lost because of the perception that he gutted public education in Pennsylvania. It was one that Democrats very successfully branded him with, that he cut public education to the tune of $1 billion. In fact, that wasn't true. A lot of that cut was due to the loss of federal stimulus money. Republican Governor Corbett did, in fact, cut public education to the tune of about $355 million, which was a big enough cut to begin with. But he was never able to successfully push back against that narrative. He was branded early on, was unable to combat that, and it's one of the things that certainly cost him re-election in 2014. Governor Wolf has long touted his support for public education, for adding more money to K-12, to special education programs, to pre-K programs, and he's now about halfway to the $2 billion in funding that he wants to add to the system.
So what exactly did Governor Wolf, if you could get a little more specific for us, when he first assumed the governor's office in 2015, he said he wanted to do this, that, and the other with public education. What did he want to do, and what has he actually been able to achieve to this point?
Okay, mostly it was to backfill the Republican increase funding for K-12 education, which they've done. They have also increased funding for pre-K programs, not as much as advocates would like. Their advocates have been pushing for something like $75 million. They haven't quite gotten there yet. They have added more money to workforce development programs and to community college funding, have boosted funding for higher education, the state system schools, that's your Shippensburgs, your Millersvilles, and to the state related, so that's Temple, Penn State, Pitt, and Lincoln universities as well. Republicans will push back and say that the only reason any of that stuff has happened is because they shepherded the bills through the General Assembly, and that Governor Wolf, by failing to sign three consecutive budgets into law, cannot credibly take credit for those increases. And they have something of a point there, but in the final analysis, the governor can say, increased funding for public education, and make a pretty credible argument that he did.
John, you write that the stakes in this election could not be higher. What are the stakes?
Well, I mean, one of them happens to be that fight over public education funding, but I think I wrote that actually in the context of the looming Supreme Court confirmation battle of federal appellate judge Brett Kavanaugh, who the Trump administration has picked to fill the vacancy of Justice Anthony Kennedy. One of the things that cultural conservatives are looking for from a more conservative court is either the overturning or steady whittling away of Roe v. Wade, 1973 decision that legalized abortion. And should that happen and Roe get turned over in some way to the states, then women's rights groups and reproductive rights groups are looking to friendly governors, in this case Tom Wolf, and to friendly legislatures to protect their interests. They're not going to get that from the Republican-controlled state legislature, where any number of bills seeking to limit a woman's right to choose have come down the pike over the last 4 years.
Where is Scott Wagner on this?
Scott Wagner is 100% pro-life. He has supported every single abortion restriction bill that's come down the pike, one that would ban abortion after 20 weeks, one that would ban abortion based on a diagnosis of Down syndrome, and one so-called heartbeat bill that would ban abortion at the very moment that at the very moment there's a fetal heartbeat, which is about 6 weeks, which is before most women have any idea that they're pregnant to begin with. Governor Wolf, a Planned Parenthood volunteer, has said he'd veto every single one of those measures. In fact, Planned Parenthood is dumping about $1.5 million into his reelection and to the election of down-ballot Democrats to keep Senator Wagner from ever being in a position to do something like that.
So Wagner also has some heavy-hitting funders. Vice President Mike Pence is raising money for him.
The vice president has been through. I'm sure we will see President Donald Trump through before all is said and done. He has been struggling to catch Governor Wolf in fundraising. As I noted earlier, the governor had something like $14.7 million compared to Wagner's $1.2 or $1.3 million. Then again, Wagner had just waged a fairly competitive three-way primary against an Allegheny County businessman named Paul Mango and attorney Laura Ellsworth, so he is now having to replenish his coffers. The campaign swears they'll be competitive in fundraising. Senator Wagner, who is sort of a self-made millionaire, has also dipped into his own pockets to help fund his campaign. And, you know, this is a big state, and the battle for the governor is often won and lost on the statewide airwaves.
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
But, you know, and so to stay competitive, you need that kind of money to stay on the air, particularly in the Philadelphia market, which is massively expensive.
Quickly, will Wolf and Wagner debate?
Yes, we know that they will. It looks like they've agreed to at least one, and that's the Chamber of Commerce debate in Harrisburg at some point during the fall. And traditionally, there have been debates in the other two media markets in Pittsburgh and in Philadelphia. Senator Wagner had initially challenged Governor Wolf to debates in all 67 counties, which is kind of a very conventional challenger trope. The Wolf campaign rejected that request, but it looks like there'll be at least three debates between now and Election Day.
All right, John Micek, to the Senate, where Democratic incumbent Bob Casey is being challenged by Republican Congressman Lou Barletta. Barletta has ties to the Trump administration, has a hardline view on immigration, has consistently trailed Casey in the polls. Is this much of a challenge to the incumbent?
Again, it's sort of the same dynamic, Mary. It's massively hard to knock off an entrenched Senate incumbent. You know, it looks like the signs are tilting Senator Casey's way. At the moment, the polling is going his way. The fundraising is going his way. Congressman Barletta, who, as you pointed out, is an immigration hawk with ties to the Trump administration, has had both President Trump and Vice President Pence through to campaign for him in the last few weeks. They, like the Wagner campaign, are pointing to this questionable Republican poll yesterday showing that the race is tighter than it actually is. But most public polling has Casey with a double-digit lead. You know, I mean, one of the things you have to do when you're trying to knock off any incumbent politician is to provide a compelling narrative for why he or she deserves to be sent back home. The Barletta people have tried to say that Senator Casey is a lockstep vote for Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, that he will stonewall the Trump administration's Supreme Court picks. But by the same token, Senator Casey, who comes from heavy union territory up there in the Northeast, has also come out and spoken fairly warmly of the administration's tariffs. So some of that argument gets neutralized a little bit. So it is most assuredly an uphill battle for the Barletta folks, and I think they know that.
So, John, the economy's growing, unemployment's down, as we know, the state, mm-hmm. to some, when shockingly, to Donald Trump in 2016. Yes. Does this still help the Republicans in the midterms in Pennsylvania as far as, you know, the economy and unemployment is concerned?
Well, I mean, that is certainly an argument that they're going to make in each of the respective congressional races, particularly those really competitive ones down in your neck of the woods as they try to hold those seats and keep them from flipping. But, Mary, as we saw out in western Pennsylvania with the special election back in March between Democrat Connor Lamb and Republican Rick Saccone, that the arguments about pocketbook issues, about the tax cuts, really didn't gain a whole lot of traction, and they were forced to go to more conventional stuff about immigration and culture war things and that sort of thing. So they haven't found the tax cuts to be as much of a ground gainer, I think, as they would have liked.
Well, you know, Connor Lamb, the Democrat, many would observe, has a conservative flair. Do Democrats mm-hmm. need to, in Pennsylvania, in many spots, need to look a little bit more like Connor Lamb in order to win?
You know, there's that long-standing trope that all politics is local, and some now will tell you that all politics is national. But the one thing that the Lamb race did show is that candidates who fit their districts tend to resonate best. I don't think you could, for instance, run sort of a Connor Lamb-style candidate in Lower Moreland. He wouldn't go over the same way as he would in Aliquippa out in Beaver County. So there is some argument to that. It looks like the Democrats in their recruitment are cognizant of that fact.
And just to the 17th for a moment, it's Pennsylvania's new 17th district after redistricting was corrected. It's now Connor Lamb versus an incumbent Republican, Keith Rothfuss, I think is how you can pronounce his name.
That's right.
And Rothfuss is likely suffering some fallout from the redrawing of the old congressional map, no?
Yeah, that district is still a Republican district, although it's not quite as Republican as it used to be. And I think they just switched the ratings on that, like Charlie Cook and Rothenberg and those guys, to make it more competitive for Democrats. And again, you've got the right kind of candidate running out there in Connor Lamb. He can neutralize a lot of those arguments that he is this, you know, just this lockstep progressive Democrat. He said he'd vote against Nancy Pelosi for minority leader, for instance. We know that he's pro-Second Amendment. We know that he has some moderate views on abortion. So it's tough for Rothfuss to come at him with the traditional lines of attack.
John, there are no women from Pennsylvania in the House of Representatives as of this time, but there will be after Election Day. 5th District, tell us about that. Pearl Kim, Mary Gay Scanlon?
There will be at least one seat in Pennsylvania that will go Republican down there. That is the former I have to recount the districts now. That is the former Pat Meehan seat, I think, in Delaware County. That one got redrawn to be more blue and more favorable. But you know, you could conceivably have as many as three women members of Congress coming out of the midterm race. There's Madeline Dean up there in Montgomery County, and Chrissy Houlihan in the 6th district, which is the former Ryan Costello seat as well.
And finally, one quick question. Does John Fetterman, longtime mayor of Braddock, win the lieutenant governor's office?
I know better than to predict things, but it certainly seems like things are going Mr. Fetterman's way.
All right. John Micek, thanks so much for the insight.
Thanks. You take care.
John is editor of the editorial and opinion pages for the Patriot News and Penn Live. And, of course, we appreciate our listeners as well. Check us out on social media. Listen to our podcasts. There's lots more Radio Times available to you. Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Great to have you along for Radio Times.